Blog Talk Radio.
Hosted by Stephen James. Today's show is going to be with very special guest Donald Nass, who is a highly respected literary agent and much sought after fiction instructor. So this is one that you don't want to miss. Stephen James, of course, is a critically acclaimed novelist and author of more than 30 books of fiction and nonfiction. I believe he has Susan May Warren as his co-host today for this show with Donald Nass. So let's not waste any time and let's just jump right into it. Today, a special edition of the Story Blender this Wednesday morning with Donald Nass.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Susan May Warren.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And I will say I'm thankful to have Susie helping me out today. And we met years ago and had a bit of a discussion about whether or not stories should have three acts. I still remember over some pizza.
Yes, it was a lively discussion that is ongoing, although I now have become a four-act writing teacher and now believe that. But you still believe that there's no acts in storytelling, so that's all right. We'll just keep working on you. So, well, it's really great to be here today, and I'm really excited because on the show today we have this amazing guest. He's one of the most respected and sought-after fiction instructors in the country. And ever since his book, Writing the Breakout Novel, came out, it was about maybe 15 years ago, and he speaks in standing room only crowds at conferences nationwide and has somehow found time to write 14 novels himself. His books are fantastic. I personally own all of them. I have a huge Donald Nass shelf. They're dog-eared. They're highlighted. I've gone to two of his retreats and learned tons of stuff that's really helped my writing. So he is a really gifted teacher. He's highly respected. He's a highly respected literary agent in New York City as well. His agency sells over 150 novels a year to publishers in America and overseas, and so we're super thrilled and honored to welcome Mr. Donald Nass to the Story Blender. Welcome, Donald.
Hi, thanks, guys.
Yeah, you might not even know this, Don, but years ago when I was first writing my first novel, I read your book, Writing the Breakout Novel, and I went through and tried to follow it to the letter when I was writing my first book, The Pawn, and so you were a huge inspiration to me, both personally and professionally over the years, and also appreciate the nice foreword you wrote in my book, Story Trumps Structure. So it's been good to get to know you a little bit over the
Absolutely.
Years, and
yeah.
I'm glad you're here today.
Well, you're welcome, and it's a pleasure.
Now, one of the things that I remember talking with you about last year was this idea that you were exploring the depth of emotionality in stories, and also like protagonists having dual different motives and stuff like that. And I was wondering if you'd had a chance to sort of sort through some of those thoughts, because I was really intrigued by the secondary emotions in scenes, things like that that you talked about. So I just wanted to jump right in and see where you're at these days with those thoughts.
Well, sure. I've been doing a lot of work in the last 2 years on what is turning into a new book, currently called The Emotional Craft of Fiction. And the idea is that the emotional effect that a novel has on readers, if it has any kind of emotional effect at all, is, for the most part, kind of accidental. I mean, authors hope to have an emotional effect. They hope to move their readers. And sometimes they do, but very often they don't. I started thinking about this when watching the Super Bowl one time, when I realized that there were 30-second commercials in the Super Bowl broadcast that were moving me more than 300 pages of some manuscripts that I was reading. And I started thinking, well, wait a minute. It's not that we should write like advertising, but on the other hand, you know, what really produces an emotional effect? And what if authors treated the emotional effect of their stories not as just something that might happen, but as a craft? If you took a look at the how you produce emotional effects, what they are, why they work, and studied it in a craft way, you could actually start to engineer and build in these effects into your fiction rather than just hoping they're there. So I have, for a couple of years now, I've been doing a lot of research in reading some psychology research in the background, reading a lot of fiction, and deconstructing just, you know, why emotional effects work when they happen and how we can do that. And I've discovered a couple of things to get to your question, Stephen. When in the world of writing instruction and talking about fiction and fiction craft, when we talk about emotions in fiction, the conversation usually revolves around characters' emotions on the page and whether it's better to show them, that is, you know, evoke whatever a character is feeling through their actions or what they say, or whether to tell the reader what the character is feeling, to simply, you know, write out their emotions in words. Showing and telling. And the general idea is that showing is better than telling. Well, I have come to feel that is a somewhat limited approach to the whole issue of the emotional effect of fiction. It's not that it's wrong to talk about character emotions, but the fact is that you actually cannot get a reader to feel what a character is feeling. Done a lot of reading and a lot of thinking about this, and but it doesn't take that much to understand that actually you are not a character in a story. You cannot possibly feel what a character is feeling any more than you can feel what I'm feeling or I can feel what you're feeling. It's what we do feel when we read is what we feel. In other words, what's happening on the page stirs up or creates a space for the reader to feel something of their own. So what does all that mean in terms of, you know, how a story is actually crafted and written, you know, in a day-to-day writing process? First of all, showing doesn't always work, and telling doesn't always work. Sometimes they work beautifully, sometimes not, and I think there are reasons for those things, which I believe I've worked out. Showing works when there's a lot of high emotion already inherent in what you're showing. Telling used to be this secondary thing that only lesser writers would do because, you know, it's so much better to show than tell. But the fact is that in the last 25 years, the art of telling emotions, writing about emotions on the page, has evolved so much and in so many new forms of fiction that, honestly, I believe it's overtaken showing as an effective way to convey the emotional experience that characters are having in a story. How you do it matters. You can't just put down the word fear and expect the reader to feel fear. That doesn't happen. What you can do, though, is create a space for the reader to feel something. And, Stephen, to get to your this issue of secondary emotions, what happens, what you can do as a writer to create feeling in readers based on what's happening at a given moment in a story is to take any moment. Dramatic moments are a little easier to talk about, but you take any moment in the story, basically, and ask the question, what does the character that we're, you know, reading about feel? And generally, what they're feeling is a strong emotion, a primary emotion, as psychologists like to say, like fear or joy or whatever. What you do as a writer, though, then, is discard that feeling. Go down one level and say, ask yourself the question, what else is this character feeling? And then go a level below that to a third level and say, what else might this character be feeling at this moment? You take that third level emotion, and this is a technique I'm teaching now. You take the third level emotion, something that's authentic, that the character is actually feeling, but you detail it in different ways. There are four principal things you can do to write about an emotion that make reading about an emotion interesting to read about, dynamic. One is to objectify that emotion by making an analogy out of it. What does it feel like to feel this feeling? Another thing is to make a judgment about it. It's good to feel this or it's bad to feel this, and here's why. The character can contemplate alternatives. What I should be feeling instead is this or that. And finally, the character often will, too, justify what they're feeling. Well, I know I should feel something else, but this is what I feel, and this is what I have to feel, and this is why. Now, when you write about emotions in that way, it typically produces a passage on the page that's longer than most passages where we explore what a character's feeling. What the effect of that is that the passage then is fresh for the reader. It's something they don't expect. It challenges them to measure against the character what they would feel in that moment. And also because of the duration of the paragraph, and actually the length of the paragraph is a factor here, creates time for the reader's brain to process what they're reading and what they're feeling and to come up with something of their own, which typically works out like this. For instance, if you start with a top-level emotion, and here's a really hoary cliche that you see in a lot of manuscripts, his guts twisted in fear. Now, we've all read that, right? We've probably written it a few times too, you know? But when you read those words, do your own guts twist in fear? No, of course they don't. It's too common. It's too familiar. And anyway, you're asking the reader to have their guts twist in fear. And who wants to feel that? No. People actually turn away from that emotion. So, but when you explore something else that the character feels at that moment, give the reader a space, well, more precisely a little bit of time, just a few seconds really, to process their own feelings, to be challenged and to wonder and ponder, you know, briefly how they're reacting to what's happening. What happens is what they feel is often what you wanted to them to feel in the first place. I did this in a workshop recently, and the predominant emotion at a particular point in a story was fear. We had the writers in the workshop explored third-level feelings, and one of the participants in the workshop read this passage, which wasn't about fear, it was about something else. I asked everybody else in the workshop, well, as she read this passage, which was very good, I said, what did you feel? And what they felt was fear. So the principle there of third-level emotions is to say that it's possible to write about emotions on the page to make them very dynamic, very effective to read about. It is not secondary to showing. But if you do it properly, you can actually produce the emotional effect that you really want in the reader, which you can by telling them what it is you want them to feel. So that's a little bit of the work I've been doing on that topic. There's a lot more to it, the author's own emotional journey through a story, and you know how you can get to things that you're resisting and avoiding and so forth. And you know, it's a really, really big topic, but it is, to my way of thinking, a craft, a dimension of the craft that we haven't really explored very much yet.
Yeah, no, I don't hear people talking about that, you know, at all. And when you were explaining that, it made me think of something one of my early writing instructors told me, and he said, always put the tear in the eye of the reader rather than the character. Okay. And when you have characters over-emoting, it doesn't affect us at all. We don't cry. But when they hold back their tears is when it affects us. And what you were saying about the primary goal is to affect the reader, not just show the character. Man, I think you're right on the nose with that.
You know, they've known this principle in playwriting for a long time. There's an expression in theater about scripts. If a line in a script is too much, as they say, on the nose, meaning that the character has to say exactly what they're feeling, it's ineffective and the audience won't feel it. You have to create a moment, an environment, a situation, or something sideways that causes the audience to feel or apprehend what the character is actually feeling. So I think playwrights are right about that. You know, if we go on the nose on the page, it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It sounds like another great Donald Musk book that we all need to get.
It will be when I finish writing it, I hope.
That's really, really great. I love that you're teaching that in your seminars already, which are Wonderful. I've actually attended two of them, and really, it really helped my writing tremendously. And you've been doing this for years, you know, writing about craft and helping people tell better stories. So what do you see as timeless principles for that, for telling great stories? You know, some of the things, you know, obviously story world and, you know, what the character wants and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, as we're approaching stories, what are the key things that you look for as a literary agent in you know, just in the manuscripts, and what are sort of the principles for telling these great stories?
Well, I think the fundamental principles of story construction and what makes novels in particular work are really pretty well known. I mean, a lot of people have written about that. I mean, there's some great texts out there that explain story structure and scene structure and all of that. The Writer's Journey by my pal Christopher Ogler is a great distillation of the hero's journey. Joseph Campbell's great work on the universal story that occurs in all cultures. What I've tried to do in my writing is to peer a little deeper into great fiction, breakout level fiction and great novels and, you know, the new forms of fiction that we're seeing here in the 21st century, and try to understand how they achieve some of what they achieve that goes beyond the standard advice. You can get the standard advice anywhere, but for me, there are some other dimensions of fiction that are kind of interesting and I think a little less well understood. For instance, we all know that we need sympathetic characters in a story in order, if readers are going to identify and find a way to, you know, care about what's going on. But the standard advice about creating characters that are like us, that we can identify with, or characters that we can cheer for, and so forth, it's good, it's fine, there's nothing wrong with any of that advice, but it doesn't explain certain things. Like, for instance, every man or every woman characters, regular people who are the subject of fiction, sometimes are fascinating and sometimes they're not.
Mm.
And why? What's the difference? And how does that difference occur on page one of a story? How can we apprehend as soon as we start a book, oh, this dentist is going to be really interesting to read about, whereas this other one is not. I can't think of too many dentist protagonists still. You see what I mean? And then there are action protagonists who are heroic, and some of them, you know, do cause us, you know, stir us up greatly right away, and others don't. Others may be doing big heroic things at the beginning of a story, and, you know, we're left kind of cold. And then there are dark characters. I mean, the last 20 years in particular have really seen the rise of the dark, tormented, semi-human or non-human protagonist characters. I mean, think vampire fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an awful lot of that stuff around, but these are dark characters. Sometimes they're off-putting. Sometimes they're deeply compelling. Why? What's the difference? And how do we know that as soon as we meet them? Well, I've worked on that, I've thought about it, and I've realized that there is a principle that we can bring into play, and that is essentially, I'll boil it down, with every man or every woman characters, what we see when we bond with them, what we see in them right away is some kind of strength, something strong or good about them, not ordinary strong or good, so that we know that there's a reason to care about this character. With heroic characters, that one puzzled me for a long time, but it was when I realized that they were so good that I had no way to connect to them, that I began to realize that when I did connect to them, it was because the author was showing me something human about this character, even while they might be rappelling out of a helicopter into a hail of gunfire.
Right.
And then with dark characters, they're essentially suffering characters, and that's very hard to read about, unless we get just an inkling right at the beginning of the story that this character is longing to change in some way, that there's a hope of some kind for this character. And when those things are operative and we experience them right away on the page, you can make any kind of character work and compelling for readers. So I've worked on stuff like that and things like plot layers and how they magnify a story, how an arc of change is not just a change that a character goes through, but an ongoing and inner struggle that happens all the way through the story. The application of that in individual scenes is kind of interesting and something else I've worked on. Like, for instance, every storyteller knows that scenes have turning points. Something changes in that building block unit of a story. But what is less well understood is that there's an inner turning point when the point of view character in a scene also changes, even a little. And if you can identify that inner turning and fold that into the scene, then there's an inner drive and power to the scene that goes beyond the plot turning, whatever it might be. I've worked on personal stakes, which are the things that make character-driven stories matter. I think I've made the case pretty well that description as such is a really outdated fiction tool.
Mm-hmm.
That is one we can get rid of. You really don't need to describe things, which probably sounds a little weird, but what replaces it is experiential description. In other words, not how things look and sound and taste and feel and so forth, but how a point of view character experiences anything, you know, from a desk like the somewhat cluttered desk I'm sitting in front of right now, or any other aspect of the world in which they find themselves. So really building the world of the story is really building the character's experience of that world.
Right.
And then the thing that really causes people to turn pages, that really makes a book readable, is a technique I call microtension. I think that's been one of my great discoveries, and teaching that has a lot of writers tell me that's really unlocked a lot for them in their fiction, and has made their fiction much more compelling and readable. It's an absolutely critical technique, I think, and that's been one of my big points in teaching story. So basically, the fundamentals are always what the fundamentals have been. What I'm interested in are the things that we understand less well that make us say things like, "Wow, this is a great book, you've got to read it," or "This is a great novel." What actually on the page causes us to attach that adjective "great" to that reading experience? What is greatness actually in black and white words? Well, you know, I'm interested in that. And what is it that makes fiction work in the 21st century? How is it different than it was in the last century? That's another thing I've been thinking about teaching and writing.
Yeah, one of the things in your book, Writing First 21st Century Fiction, I remember you were talking about characters that we want to spend time with, that protagonists often in people, especially aspiring writers, are real downers. And, you know, I've been looking at some aspiring writers, protagonists and some things like that, and a lot of times they're just whiny or uninteresting or just plain mean. And I'm just like, why do you think writers so often give us the exact opposite of what we want? What are they trying to accomplish? It's like you start reading this protagonist or this main character, and it's like, I don't want to spend time with this person. This person is just bugging me.
And yet, Stephen, there are times when we meet characters who are totally miserable, and even bad people, and yet we find them very compelling. You can go back to a long way to Crime and Punishment, but you can go to writers like Patricia Highsmith and Tom Ripley, her character, who's a crook, a criminal, a killer, and yet he's a highly compelling series protagonist. You can go to novels like last year's, you know, ginormous success, Gone Girl. A story of a dissolving marriage, and you know, the wife goes missing, and the big mystery is, you know, did he do away with her or not? And they're two completely unworthy, miserable characters in their marriage.
Yeah.
Horrible. I mean, truly, truly nightmarish. And yet, it's utterly compelling. It's so, I mean, it's this enormous bestseller, got turned into a movie and so on and so on. So when you meet unpleasant characters and like them anyway, to me the question is, well, why? And
yeah,
how can I do that?
Right.
How can I steal that? And I think there is a trick to it, which is that these characters are in some way pre-redeemed. In other words, they're miserable, they're suffering, they're whatever, but we know, we get hints from the author that this character is going somewhere else, this character wants to change, this character is self-aware, this character calls their own self out on their flaws and failings. that honesty is a disarming quality, and it can take away a lot of the sting of reading about characters who, you know, in real life, in social situations, we would avoid. You know, if you're at a party, say, and somebody comes up to you and goes, oh, my elbow, oh, my gosh, let me tell you what happened. I mean, do you draw closer and say, wow, you're in pain? Tell me more about that. No, of course you don't do that. We turn away from pain. But if a friend calls you up one day, a friend that you've been avoiding because they're getting drunker and drunker in social situations, and they call you up one day and say, I have a problem, and I don't know what to do. What do you do? Do you hang up the phone and say, hey, you embarrassed me last time I saw you? No, you say, stay on the line. I'm coming right over. We're going to get you some help, right? It's that awareness, that need to change, can make an awful lot of unpleasant stuff palatable to read about, because it has a psychological effect on the reader. It's because essentially it creates in the reader hope, and that'll take us a long way.
Now, do you think in Gone Girl there was that underlying hope or pre-redeemed kind of feeling, or do you think they were just both pretty much psychopaths?
Well, without spoiling the enormous twist in the middle of the book, and if any of your listeners have not read Gone Girl, I won't spoil it. There is a huge, one of the biggest twists I've ever read in the middle of this story, and it's great. Totally worth reading just for that. But the fact is that it's about two characters who are in an unhappy marriage, and neither of them are really great or nice people. But are they pre-redeemed? Yes. The main narrator in the first half of the novel is the husband, whose wife disappears. He's a lousy husband, but the thing is, he knows it. And he tells you that. And he's regretful. Not a lot, but he is regretful. And he's searching and wondering, and his wife is gone, and it matters to him. And even though he's a lousy jerk of a guy, you have some hope for him. Now, what actually happens to him, well, that makes for quite a story. But we wouldn't read about him if we didn't really have an underlying reason to care. It's there. It's subtle. It's hard to see. None of the reviewers wanted to write about it because they were just delighted that, you know, there was this wonderful book about these dark characters and it was so good and so much fun to read. They didn't want to tell you, hey, you're really going to like this guy. No, what they wanted to say, the reviewers, was, oh, at last, a horrible, dark, terrible, terrible book that's still really, really good. So, to answer your question, Stephen, yes.
Yeah.
I do think those characters are pre-redeemed.
That's interesting. It was a great book. Fantastic, actually.
Oh, it's a great read. Absolutely fabulous read, yeah.
Go ahead, Susie.
Oh, no, go ahead, Susan. I was just going to ask about, you know, aspiring authors. And, you know, obviously every author wants to get to that next level. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to look at your own work and go, what's missing, right? What am I not doing right? And obviously getting your books is hugely helpful because people can kind of break it down and go, wait, am I adding these plot layers? Am I, you know, doing the character work and this sort of thing? But what do you see as some of the greatest weaknesses that in today's authors, you know, especially the ones that have maybe gotten published but haven't necessarily risen in the ranks, maybe are, you know, C-level or B-level authors? What are their sort of greatest weaknesses?
Oh, what a great question, Susan. That's a really, there are so many authors who do get published who don't achieve the kind of success that they would like to achieve, and they wonder why.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, they will start to blame their publisher, and if that doesn't work, they'll blame their agent, you know, and try to make changes that will somehow fix the problems with their career. But I think we all know in our heart of hearts that 90% of success is locked in when you turn a manuscript into your publisher. It's all about what's on the page.
Mm-hmm.
The public doesn't care who your publisher is. The public doesn't care who your agent is. I mean, that's none of that really matters. What matters is the story you're telling and the way you're telling it. Now, why don't people why don't people achieve the kind of success they want? There are a lot of technical reasons, but one of them that's really hard to talk about, and especially hard for people to identify because they're so close to what they're doing, is when fiction is basically imitative.
Mm.
When writers are doing essentially what a lot of other people are doing, it's very, very difficult to stand out and achieve a wider audience. Every fiction writer thinks they're original. And, hey, they're good enough to get published, so, you know, something's going right there.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be too slavishly imitative of other things. There's got to be something new in what they're doing. You know, they've achieved a certain level of acceptance and success, and that's all good.
Mm-hmm.
But many of these same writers think they are or feel that they are doing something that's unique when really they've got simply a new idea about vampires, or they've come
mm-hmm.
up with a different kind of detective that's a little different than the last detective. And all that's fine, and there's nothing wrong with that, and entertaining the audience and writing crime stories or vampire stories for that matter. There's nothing wrong with that. It's okay. It's just that when one is doing something that is essentially familiar and rewarding readers for coming back to the kind of thing that they've enjoyed before, it's never going to have the same kind of cognitory effect on readers that something very new, very mm-hmm. fresh, and very different is going to do. I can tell you this because at my own practice as a literary agent, the most successful clients we represent are people who started out doing something that nobody else was doing at the mm-hmm. time. For instance, a historical mystery writer, Ann Perry, started publishing in the late 70s. And she, along with another writer named Ellis Peters, started setting mysteries in the past. Well, at the time, nobody else was doing that. It was unheard of. Today, it's very common. There are hundreds of historical mystery series, but they were the first. And they did it very, very well. And partly because there were no novel models for what they were
mm-hmm.
doing,
mm-hmm.
they really had to write like novelists, really had to find a way to tell their own kind of story and make it work on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they're not good crime stories, they are, but they really had to find their own way as novelists. More recently, around the turn of the century, a writer named that we also represent named Jim Butcher came along, and he started writing a series of noir pastiche, you know, very funny, very sharp, gumshoe detective stories set in contemporary Chicago, except that the detective is a wizard. And, it's called The Dresden Files, this series, now number one New York Times best-selling series, and hugely successful. But when you started out, even we were scratching our heads thinking, well, what is this? Is it fantasy? Is it crime fiction? Is it satire? I mean, you know, what is this
mm-hmm.
thing? It was very difficult to figure out, but we did have to make some choices and figure out, you know, the publishing pattern that this was going to follow. The basic decision was, well, the most appreciative readers are probably going to be over in the science section and fantasy section of the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
So he was launched that way in that kind of imprint. Well, today he's got such a wide following that he's, you know, just way beyond any kind of genre boundaries. He's a brand name author, and that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when
mm-hmm.
somebody's doing something very, very unique, very original, and doing it, by the way, very well, those are the writers that really become brands, that really can capture a wide audience, because they're doing something new, they're doing something fresh, they're doing something that really stirs up readers in ways that more imitative fiction doesn't.
So we need to search for that new idea, that fresher take, in order to sort of launch ourselves into that new place. You know, maybe expand our minds a little bit more and not write sort of the same old.
Oh,
is that
absolutely.
What you're kind of saying? Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And often that stretch that writers make comes from a very personal place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a blog monthly on a website called Writer Unboxed, which is
mm-hmm.
about the craft and business of fiction writing.
Mm-hmm.
I do craft posts there on the first Wednesday of every month. And there's another contributor there, though, a middle grade and young adult writer named Robin Lefevers. She sort of limped along in her career, as she puts it, writing middle grade fiction. And she wasn't really kind of getting where she wanted to get to, and she realized that she was writing what she felt she should write. But then she decided to just strike out and write the book of her heart, which she did. And her publisher bought it, and they decided, you know, they were going to give it a big launch. It was much longer. It was much more personal. It was, you know, the book that she really, really wanted to write. And it was a book about medieval assassin nuns. And when I read this, I thought, now, Robin is a wonderful writer, and she's a very inspiring blogger. I mean, her posts are about inspiration for writers, and they're really, really wonderful. But I read this, and I thought to myself, the book of your heart is about medieval assassin nuns? Really?
Yeah.
Well, I thought, well, I got to read this one. And so I did. And I have to tell you, it's a book called Grave Mercy, and there's been a bunch of follow-ups to it since then. And I got to tell you, she, within 20 pages, she totally, completely sold me on the idea of these medieval assassin nuns in Brittany and France in the 1300s.
Wow.
And it's a passionate book. It's a believable book. It's a crazy, wild, speculative story, and yet you sink right into it, and it's so real. She came from a very personal and passionate place in writing this book, and she totally made it work. Medieval assassin nuns. And
wow.
There you go. And it was a big breakout for her.
Wow, that's a great story. And I read, by the way, your blogs on Writer Unboxed. I think they're great.
Thank you.
And but I love that. It's really a great encouragement, because there's so many authors that are like, well, I better write another Amish book, you know, or you know, or whatever, you know, and you're like, no, please God, no. And but you know, for those that are like, okay, what do I really want to write? What does make me passionate? You know, and I guess that passion does, you know, translate onto the page and makes for a better read too. So that's fantastic. So we'll all have to pick up those Murderous Nun books and see what they have in them. So, well, that's great. Thanks for that.
And one of the things that's interesting, too, when you're speaking about that, is I think of so many writing conferences and so on, and someone say, well, what are you writing, and what genre is it? And, like, that's one of the first questions is they want to pigeonhole it into a specific genre. And you're talking about doing ones that hopscotch across genres.
Oh, that's the trend. The trend, it's more than a trend. It's the movement of literature in the 21st century. I mean, I wrote about this in the book you mentioned, Stephen, Writing 21st Century Fiction. There are a lot of reasons for this. One of them is that the range of influence on fiction writers today is much, much broader than it was 50 years ago. 50 years ago, if you're a science fiction writer, you were a science fiction writer, and you probably read science fiction.
Right.
Same thing with crime. Today, because, you know, there's younger generations of writers coming through that have read widely and read a lot, you find literary writers borrowing characters and ideas from you know, the literature of crime or writing in fantastic and speculative settings. There's the blending of genres, the crossing of genres, the mashup of genres is just one indicator of what's happening. I think the bigger movement, though, the century-long movement, is a confluence, a merging of commercial and literary intent and style, even in fiction. There are some economic reasons for that. There's some underpinning reasons for that, but I'll just mention it briefly. The world of publishing and books and book retailing has evolved a lot, particularly in the last 15 years, and it's changed quite a bit. One of the changes that's been the most surprising to me is the disappearance almost of the mass market paperback, replaced now by as a price point by e-books, and the rise of hardcovers and trade paperbacks as the main print vehicle for fiction. But those books are priced higher, And what readers want when they're paying $25 for a hardcover is not just a pulpy, you know, genre story, although you can find those. What they really want is an immersive and strong reading experience. They want to be entertained like they're reading commercial fiction, but they want a reading experience like literary fiction. That's the simplest way to put it.
Yeah.
And you can see this in literary quality crime fiction that breaks out. You can see this in literary fiction that borrows a lot of the plot tropes from and plot techniques from entertainment. There's a confluence, there's a conjunction of these two things happening. But in writing terms, there's an issue because in the world of fiction writers, there's a cultural divide. There's a world of commercial. Yeah, you know this, you guys. There's a, and you know right away what I'm talking about. Over there is the camp of literary writers and their MFA programs, and over here, all the commercial writers with their, you know, writers' organizations and conferences and, you know, web presence and all. And the literary writers look across the gulf at the commercial writers and kind of, you know, screw up their faces and hold their noses a little bit and say, oh, that commercial stuff, it's all alike, isn't it? And then the commercial writers feel the same thing about the literary stuff, all that frou-frou, you know, you know, pretty, pretty, pretty words, all that imagery,
right.
You know, it's all the same. Well, the fact is that there's an audience for each of those things, and both of those camps have something that the other camp needs. But how do you talk to literary writers about that dirty word plot? And really, truly, go teach it an MFA program and bring up the word plot and see what happens. It's watching. It's like opening a window in a crypt with vampires. They all kind of recoil and go, plot! Oh, no, not plot! Because to them, that's the gimmicky stuff with guns and car chases that you paste
right.
onto a story so that people will read it. On the other hand, commercial fiction writers are apt to say things like, I'm a storyteller, baby, and I laugh all the way to the bank, and you can keep your pretty words. I don't need that. But actually, they do. And actually, those literary writers need more in the way of dynamic storytelling. So how do you craft a vocabulary that talks to literary writers about story events and commercial writers about what makes writing beautiful, which is not only pretty imagery and pretty words? There's a lot more to it than that. And there are things that we like and things that we can do and things that don't hurt, you know, when you write in each direction. So that's what I see happening. Here's my prediction. I think 100 years from now, bookstores are going to be more, and we will still have print bookstores, I believe. There may be fewer of them, and they may be smaller, but we're going to have them. And I think they're going to be more like bookstores were 100 years ago. 100 years ago, there were no sections in bookstores. There wasn't a science fiction section and a horror section and a romance section. There was just books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we're going again, to a place where the influences, the intents, the style, the way stories are told can be anything and everything as long as it's great.
Mm.
And that's what my book is about and how that's done and how, you know, you can do the things that you're not doing to make your fiction, you know, strong and effective and really, you know, write fiction that people want to read today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. While you were talking, I just pulled up this quote from John Grisham when he says, for me, it's an essential component of fiction is plot. The objective is to get the reader to feel impelled to turn the pages as quickly as possible. If I want to achieve that, I can't allow myself the luxury of distracting him. I have to keep him hanging on, and the only way to do that is by using the weapons of suspense. Then he says, if I try to understand the complexity of the human soul, people's character defects and those types of things, the reader gets distracted. And he talks a little bit about like literature and how he's, you know, not connected with it. But when you read his stuff, he does use the tools of suspense, but he also does touch on the complexities of human nature.
Absolutely, and I would go further with that. I would say that what he does, he may not feel that he does this, he may not believe in it, but what he does is keep us guessing about his characters. He creates characters of complexity and then doesn't explain them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons we keep reading his books is, well, he is very, very good at making us turn the pages with the plot mechanics, But the character, we wouldn't do that if we weren't connected in some way to those characters. And there's a lot of science, by the way, that shows us this. There's been a lot of research into the psychology of entertainment, why people choose entertainment, what they, you know, why it works for them. And one of the fundamental principles in psychology is that you cannot, readers will not be involved in a story if they are not involved with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different ways to do that. The primary way is that if characters are good in some way, if readers make a positive moral judgment about characters very quickly, they'll keep reading about them.
Uh-huh.
But another is that they're intriguing, that there are things to discover about characters. And I think Grisham does that very well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
remember,
he definitely does. There's lots of layers to his characters, even though he doesn't necessarily explain them, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, he works with a lot, or he did in his early work, a lot with protagonists of mystery. Very often you would find out very little about his protagonists. The jury was a great example of
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
There's this mystery juror. And the first 200 pages of that book are all about the antagonists and how they're trying to manipulate this trial about, it's a class action suit about cigarettes, and they're trying to manipulate the jury. But there's this rogue juror who slips through, and he's a mystery character. And what he's trying to do and his motives are very it's withheld from the reader for almost 200 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, you know, it's kind of a reverse psychology on the reader. But I was hooked. I want to know, who is this guy? What
mm-hmm.
what is he doing, and why? And the why of it, which you find mm-hmm. out later in the mm-hmm. story, is really good and really compelling. And
Yeah,
see, I wouldn't say he's a writer who eschews, character depth.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
There's some, among story theorists, I've run into different people who say stories are there to change characters, and stories are there to reveal characters. And personally, I feel like stories can do both, and it depends a little bit upon the emphasis of the struggle, if it's internal, external, and so on. But when you were talking just a moment ago, it made me think of that, of how when we have these mysterious characters and we're intrigued by them, as the story progresses, more and more of that character is revealed to us, and that becomes satisfying.
Well, hopefully. Stories that, are one note, you know, one conflict, say, churned over and over again, will gradually have a dulling effect on the reader. You need to, as a storyteller, keep introducing fresh elements and new dimensions of a character, new aspects of a character, new sides of a character are one of many ways to do that.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I was mm-hmm. taking notes with one hand typing.
I took tons of notes. I have, like, notes everywhere. It's fantastic.
While you were talking, Donald. So if readers want to get in touch with you or maybe see what you're up to these days, where's the best place to point them?
My literary agency's website is www.massagency.com. That goes MAASSAGENCY.com. You can follow me on Twitter as well, @DonMoss. And I have a Facebook page, so if you want to see pictures of my kid and stuff, you can you can go there. But follow me on Twitter, visit our website, and you'll find out, among other things, where I'll be teaching and speaking and things like that.
Well, thanks for joining us. This has been a real treat for me to hear some of your insights and especially some of the emerging ideas that you have. And we'll look forward to some of those new books about,
mm-hmm.
Don't wait too long before you write those, because we're going to want to read them, add them to our bookshelves. So everyone, thanks for listening. You can check out my latest releases and my books at stephenjames.net.
And you can find mine at susanmaywarren.com.
And for more info about our other guests and to check out other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, that was great.